966.
Hello and welcome to the 966, episode 127. Thank you for joining us. Thanks so much for listening in. We're delighted to have with us today the U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Mr. Michael Ratney. He's in Saudi Arabia at a pivotal time, an exciting moment, and one with great possibilities in terms of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So we're excited to hear his perspective. I want to add, before we jump into the conversation, that the ambassador mentioned that in prepping for his confirmation and in prepping for his position in Riyadh, he listened to episodes of the 966, which we're delighted to hear and quite flattered. With no further ado, U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Michael Ratney.
Hello, we are pleased and honored to have U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Mr. Michael Ratney, with us today on the 966. A quick glance at news headlines reflects the fact that the United States is deeply engaged with Saudi Arabia on a variety of critical and ongoing regional and global issues. In fact, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is scheduled to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman this week. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Saudi Arabia just recently as well. So in light of these very pressing diplomatic responsibilities for you and your staff, we feel very fortunate to have this opportunity to speak with you, Mr. Ambassador, and welcome.
Thanks very much.
But let's jump right into it. You were named U.S. Ambassador just about 1 year ago. And you are, in fact, the first career diplomat to hold this position since Chaz Freeman in 1992. Also, the ambassador position had been vacant for 2 years prior to your arrival. So clearly your inbox was very full when you got to Riyadh. How has this past year been in terms of getting up to speed and engaging with Saudi leadership?
Yeah, it was a very full inbox and it keeps getting more full, it seems, as every day goes by. It's been just an extraordinary year, I have to say. I'll tell you, we had a very good chargé running the embassy for those 2 years. She's now our ambassador in Abu Dhabi. Martina Strong is doing a great job. We've had a whole series of very good ambassadors. It's true, I'm the first career foreign service officer to do this in over 30 years, which is kind of a special privilege for me, I have to say. Also because this is just such a fascinating relationship for the United States, and also to have a front row seat for everything that's happening inside the country is a really special experience. It's been quite a year. And I think it's helped by the fact that the relationship is in a good place. And my reception since I've been here has been superb. So I've had great opportunities to engage with the Saudi government at all levels and across the whole country, with the business community, with government officials and local officials, not just in Riyadh and Jeddah and Dhahran, but in a lot of other cities that I've had the chance to visit. So this whole year has been an opportunity for me to basically understand this country better, to understand it not just from the perspective of all of the developments here in Riyadh, but everything that's going on nationwide, to get to know Saudi officials, but also to do it in the context of a lot of bilateral activity. As you mentioned, Jake Sullivan's visit, this is probably his third since I've been here. Secretary Blinken was here just a week or two ago, I think. That was his fourth or fifth since I got to the country. And at every level of our government, we've had senior level visitors from the Pentagon, from the Department of State. Managing those visits, it's a lot of work, but it's great for the relationship because it really helps build personal contact between senior officials from Washington and the whole kind of spectrum of Saudi officials.
Well, I want to get to Vision 2030, but while we're talking about the U.S. relationship, if we can, pursue that a little bit. When I had the opportunity to visit with you at the ambassador's residence late last year in Riyadh, one of the things I mentioned is how exciting it seems to be in your position at this moment in time. And I say that because the U.S.-Saudi relationship has seen plenty of crises and stresses. There's always been a sort of a perhaps oversimplistic energy for security framework. Is it fair to say that this basic paradigm for the relationship is currently being reevaluated by both Saudi Arabia and the United States and evolving, you know, to fit more current, updated needs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. You say energy for security. Think about it. Originally, people would say oil for security.
Right.
And I think even that was a a bit of an oversimplification even back in the day. Now I would say it's oil and security and technology and education and culture and counterterrorism and green energy and regional stability and artificial intelligence. It's the relationship is just so multifaceted at this point. Obviously, energy is still a big part of it. Security is still a big part of it. But one of the joys of working in this job right now is just every possible dimension of this relationship has expanded. And in ways that I think a lot of people who know the kingdom well from years gone by are even surprised at how important it is. The cultural relationship is a great example. Film and television and historical preservation. Green energy, which is a huge focus of the United States right now, and I think little known to a lot of people, it's a major focus of Saudi Arabia at this point. Educational exchange, always been important and only getting more so at this stage in our relationship. So it's true, it's a lot more than oil and it's a lot more than security.
And can you as you mentioned, you know, we have Jake Sullivan has come in and the Secretary of State has been in. Increasingly, Saudi Arabia, always geostrategically important, as you mentioned, oil security, you know, any number of reasons why Saudi Arabia is a valuable partner. But it seems like in so many turns and so many critical events going on in the region, Saudi Arabia is at the heart of this. And it feels to me, having watched the relationship when President Biden came in and it was a little tense, that in the ensuing 2 years or so, that as a result of these very necessary engagements on these diplomatic crises and these needs, that the relationship has deepened and broadened. And can you share any insights, you know, on this process? Because it just seems like the trust level's gone up, the range of communication has gone up. I mean, it's just the relationship to me feels like it's in a good place.
Yeah, I suppose any bilateral relationship goes through its ups and downs. I will say by the time I got here, which was almost exactly a year ago, it felt like we were in a good place. And I felt like we were definitely on the right trajectory. And I felt it both from what I was hearing and feeling from Saudi, both officials and ordinary Saudi citizens that I would interact with, who to a person would express in some cases relief or in some cases just kind of contentedness that the relationship was where it ought to be and was growing. And I felt it from Washington too. A big part of what I have been trying to do is to encourage as many people as possible from Washington, that is from the government, but also from throughout the United States to actually get on a plane and visit here. And that includes members of Congress who may either not know the kingdom at all or may have preconceptions about it that need to be revisited. Folks from the administration, whether it's the State Department, the Department of Energy, you name it, from law enforcement, from the Pentagon, to come get on a plane, come and visit this country and see what's going on. And I think in doing that, they are reminded not just that a lot of the transformations that are happening in the kingdom right now are real and are very much in America's interest that they be real, but also they see the value of the partnership, which I think is critically important. And I think that's one of the things that I've seen over the course of the past year is increasing understanding that these developments in this country are real. They're in Saudi's interest and America's interest, but also the value of this partnership is just enormous.
It's got to be fascinating for you to see the candid before and after perspectives of these visits. But let's speak about the vision 2030. And as you are well aware, there's plenty of vision plans. You know, Bahrain has one, Qatar, UAE, they all have vision plans. Other countries have vision plans. Vision 2030 for Saudi Arabia, really, from my perspective, at both strategically and at the ground level, has been pursued rigorously and with full intent. What is your assessment of the Vision 2030 plan and the progress to date? And what are some of the most fundamental changes you've seen?
You know, it's so interesting what you say, because I had the same observation, which is a lot of countries have national social and economic development plans, but I've rarely seen one that is pursued with this degree of discipline. And everywhere I go, whatever ministry I'm in, whatever region I'm in, Saudis, officials, employees, people at all levels understand what Vision 2030 is all about, and they understand their place in it. pretty much everyone in every ministry can tell you what their KPIs, their key progress indicators are. It's hardwired into people at this point. So they know where they're supposed to go and they know the benchmarks about how to get there. But even, I think even more important than that is they kind of like where it's going. And that's the big thing. When you have actual buy-in on the direction of the country, the progress is towards an end state that people are really kind of jazzed about. And you see it at all levels of society. I think, you know, you asked me, where is it most apparent? I think it's got to be most apparent in the role of women in the economy and the workforce here in society in general. I still get emails and calls from people who are contemplating visiting here. And some of them are dissuaded by their perception of the status of women from 5 or 10 years ago. And I have to tell them, get on a plane and come here and your mind will be blown. The degree of just women's participation in the workforce, just that metric, has already exceeded their goals for that they wanted to reach by 2030. The sheer kind of visibility of women in the workplace, every ministry I go to, every place I go, there are women from all walks of life who are part of the workforce. And it's both, you know, it's a societal need to be sure, but it's also an economic need, as I think the leadership here recognized. If you exclude half the workforce, half the population from your workforce, you're never going to reach the economic growth targets that you need. But it's also led to a kind of transformation in societal attitudes too. It's not just that women can work or that they can drive, which is something that Americans tend to focus on, but it's a whole range of restrictions that have been imposed on women historically and legally are mostly gone at this point. And that's probably the most kind of obvious manifestation and the most important one, actually. But also just, you know, one of the major goals of Vision 2030 is diversification of the economy. Clearly, the Saudis are looking to the future. Whenever that post-fossil fuel era begins, no one quite knows, but they want to be ready with a viable economy at that point. And so seeing an economy that has been historically based on, obviously, energy exports, now absolutely determined to diversify their economy, to develop an industrial base, either through localization of production or through attraction of investment from overseas or through development of their own capacities, looking to sectors like technology, manufacturing, a whole range of things which were never kind of obvious candidates for an economy like Saudi Arabia. But now you look and they're absolutely determined to develop that kind of diverse economy, both because it's important now, but it's also going to be critically important in the post-fossil fuel era.
That diversification is, as you say, is at the core of so much what they're trying to do economically. And a lot of that is to try and catalyze the private sector. But also a big part of that is attracting foreign investment. And I'm sure you see that when you deal with U.S. corporates and others. Saudi Arabia has tried to massively increase ease of access, regularize its regulatory reform, just make it much more easy to invest. What's the feedback you get from U.S. corporates interested, both who have been in the country, but also want to get into the country?
So it's an interesting question. The ones who have been in this market for a long time, there's a lot of American companies that have been here for a long time, and actually not just in the energy sector, many in the defense sector, but a whole range of other industries. The ones that have been in Saudi Arabia and know the country, in many ways, I think they're starting to grapple with how that meshes with Saudi's own ambitions to develop their own economy and their own industrial base. And clearly, the biggest piece of that is Saudi's ambitions to localize production. And, you know, this was a country that often just imported what they needed, and now they want to start to manufacture what they need. And their targets for that are quite ambitious, and they're quite determined. And I think part of what we do is work with U.S. companies to kind of help them understand the environment and also work with the Saudi government, whether it's the Ministry of Investment or other parts of the Saudi bureaucracy, to help them navigate that. That's a big part of what we do. We work with the American Chamber of Commerce here on that. And then for companies that have never been here before, we spend a lot of time. We have a pretty robust commercial operation at the embassy, and we spend a fair amount of time identifying promising sectors where we think American companies have a comparative advantage, and getting them interested in coming here. In some cases, we organize trade delegations. We recruit American companies, some big ones, some small ones, some that know the kingdom a little bit, some that have never been here. and we organize a program. We work with Saudi counterparts to get them here. And just since I've been here, we've done a few. We had one in the healthcare sector that attracted a huge range of American companies, everything from big hospital organizations in the US to small and medium-sized companies that make medical devices that came here. And I think almost to a person, they were really stunned and happily so at the range of opportunities and the sophistication of the partners that they found here. We did one in healthcare. We did one, obviously, Saudi's investing big in infrastructure, logistics, transportation. So we did a separate trade delegation bringing companies, US companies that are specialized in that area, work closely with the Saudi ministries and kind of introduce them to potential projects and potential partners here. So that's the other big piece, getting US companies that we think have opportunities growing out of the diversification of the economy and getting them interested in this market.
One of the things I've been impressed with regard to the Vision 2030 process, and we're 8 years into it, it was launched in 2016, is the receptivity of the Saudi government to other inputs. You know, and, you know, I see in Nitekat, you know, Saudization, and, but any number of regulatory initiatives that they put out, there's some feedback. Okay, we'll adjust, you know, the data law, this sort of thing. Do you find that they're receptive when it, say, so when a US company or an advocacy group comes back and says, we're having issues with IP, we're having issues with data security. Do you have people listening in terms of the Saudi governance?
Yeah, I think we do. We have good partners. Data protection law is a good example. You know, that was something where they came out and understand that they're creating new regulatory frameworks. As this economy starts to diversify, they need to create new and modern regulatory frameworks for it. And a lot of this stuff they're creating either from scratch or they're revising decades old, out of date regulatory frameworks. So a lot of it's very new. The data protection law is a good example where the first draft was shared with industry. Industry, either through us, through the Chamber of Commerce or others, had a lot of feedback. They took it on board. They made revisions because they understood that ultimately the viability of attracting foreign direct investment, including American direct investment, depends on whether there's a perception that these regulatory frameworks are fair and transparent. So we, just since I've been here, we've spent quite a bit of time sort of as a convener, bringing together various parts of the Saudi government and representatives of US industry and with us in the room to have open conversations and giving the Saudis input and allowing the Saudis to share with US industry their perspective on why they're shaping certain regulations in certain ways. And it's become, I think, a very kind of healthy conversation. And our intention, and we have great support both from US industry and from the Saudis on this, is to continue that in various sectors as they emerge.
I think that's an overlooked point, and you put your finger on it. You know, some of these things didn't exist. Some of the things, but mostly in the process of going through and implementing them, they're trying to achieve international standards and best practices. So it's not as if they're just trying to, hey, we need something. We need a framework. We want something that is compatible with the globe. And I think that's an important change across almost every sector. And it sort of leads me to ask about some of these recent, very important changes in the legal code. And really significant, trying to sort of adapt or not adapt, but you know, it's based on Sharia law. They're trying to codify the law so it's accessible globally and it meets international standards. How is that process coming along?
Yeah, I have to say, I'm for a task that you might think would take a generation, because they're revising not just the legal code, but the cadre of people who are implementing it, lawyers right. And prosecutors right. And whole kind of ecosystem in the legal and judicial space. Given how thorny some of these issues are and how deeply rooted they are in society, I'm generally surprised at how quickly they're going. They have a new commercial code. They're, as I understand it, about to promulgate a new kind of criminal penalty code to start to standardize that. They've started to take a whole range of areas that were, as you say, originally kind of rooted in a judge's interpretation of Sharia law and recognizing that that is not necessarily fully compatible with the kind of targets of modernity and attraction of international business that they want. So they've been moving very, very quickly. We've been keen to offer them advice if we ever have opportunities to do that. And clearly it's something that is a major preoccupation for US companies that want to know that they're not just getting into a transparent and fair regulatory environment, they're getting into a transparent and fair judicial environment as well. Right. And that's clearly been a major priority for the Saudi government to move in that direction.
Now, you're going to have to bear with me because I'm all fired up because it's fun to talk with you. I have some sympathy for ministers, you know, modern day ministers, because the crown prince is, you know, he's a from morning till late night. He's a hard worker. He's a bulldozer. He has high expectations. Everybody's working hard. The mandate to the embassy has increased significantly as well, because, for example, you know, the underpinnings of new laws is training people to how to interpret and apply them. And that's true of almost every sector. Saudi Arabia not only has to come in and do regulatory reform, they also have to train up people who can implement and that sort of thing. This, right, I've always felt is somewhere an area where the U.S. could be of tremendous assistance. But to the point, to my question is, in your capacity as head of this embassy, have you had to adapt to all the new interfaces, all the new ways to engage for the U.S. in the Saudi society and Saudi economy?
You know, there's certainly, I visited here in the past. I haven't worked here for any extended period of time, but I have the sense that there's far more people working on a lot of the issues that we care about, and they're working far longer hours than I ever imagined. So we have to adapt to that, to be sure. That people, particularly the ministers and people at senior levels of this government, boy, do they work long hours. And I guess it's great for us because I also have to work on Washington hours as well. Right. So I feel like I'm up all night kind of answering emails from Washington. But I always know, no matter how late it is, there's always somebody in the Saudi government that's going to answer my WhatsApp message because they're also up. And like, I don't think it's just because like they're told to work long hours. I think it's because, as I was saying earlier, they understand where they're headed. They have a huge degree of determination to get there, and they like the direction that it's going in. So they're kind of jazzed about doing that. They probably need more people at that level to work on some of these things because mm-hmm. the tasks they're taking on are so ambitious. And it's in every conceivable area of society, education and health and telecommunications and high technology, manufacturing, you name it. And clearly one of the things that certainly U.S. companies mentioned to me is the need for human capital. They need qualified people to work in sometimes very technical and very specialized areas. They exist here. They're in demand. And I think they see it as kind of, in some sense, it might be a generational challenge, but they don't have time for a generation. They need people quickly that are going to work in these areas because the tasks are so large and the ambition is so fast.
You know, you've referenced two key sectors of society, women, and then as well senior ministers, but, you know, government, and how fundamental and deep their buy-in has been to Vision 2030. And I'd want to add youth, because the energy enthusiasm there, the buy-in is complete. And I agree with you. Your sentiment early on is it's very hard for people to sort of grasp that. It's hard for someone like me, who's not as, you know, on the ground as you are, but to convey the buy-in is complete. And enthusiasm and energy is genuine. But I must ask you, and it would be a dereliction of duty, I think, if I didn't. Saudi Arabia is at the heart of some really high policy in terms of what's going on in Gaza and the future of the Middle East, really, in terms of how we want to see the Middle East evolve and the region evolve. And it seems to me that Saudi Arabia and the U.S. are very much on the same page on what they'd like to see after. And so the question is, in these discussions about the relationship with U.S., you know, things, discussions of a defense pact, discussions of support for nuclear, discussions of how to bring Israel along so it can better engage and be part of the region. Can you share any insights on these?
Yeah, all of what you just said has, in addition to everything we were just talking about, everything that you just said is also simultaneously a major preoccupation. Yes. This embassy of me personally, of my colleagues in Washington who visit here, you know, the way I think about it, you know, Saudi Arabia clearly has ambitions to be kind of a modern participant in the global economy. They see their role as increasingly global, but they're still a part of this region. They're very much a part of this region, and they're affected by what's happening in this region. Everyone must be affected by what's happening in this region. Obviously, the war in Gaza, what's happening in Yemen. The war in Gaza since October 7th has been an enormous preoccupation of ours. It's one of the reasons why Secretary Blinken has come here so frequently, is because kind of as part of his duty to talk to our regional partners, not only about what's happening now, but what comes next. Clearly, talking with the Saudis is a part of that, just as he would go to Abu Dhabi or Jordan or Egypt or Qatar or Israel, for that matter. The situation has been, you know, hard to overstate it. It's been really grim. It's been tough. We have been working to both simultaneously stop the violence, to get to a cessation of the violence, but also to get the hostages that Hamas took released, because we see those two things as going hand in hand, ultimately leading to some kind of settlement, an end to this conflict. You have to do both. You need a ceasefire. You need a release of the hostages. You also need to talk about what comes after that. And that's also been a big part of what Secretary Blinken and others who've come here repeatedly over the past months have been engaging the Saudis on, because we want them to be aware of our thinking. We want to engage them and see their ideas. This is ultimately the region that they live in, and they need to be a part of it. They understand, and I think we have a great meeting of the minds on a lot of these issues, including, you know, the need not just for an end of the violence and a release of the hostages, but an increasingly clear sense of what comes next. Entry of humanitarian goods by land, by sea, by air, by any means necessary. Revitalization of the Palestinian Authority to govern both in the West Bank and Gaza, and to provide security both in the West Bank and in Gaza, ultimately, to find some way to rebuild all of the destruction that's taken place, and to maintain that in an environment of security that gives both Palestinians and Israelis and others in the region some confidence that this isn't going to happen again. So that's not something we can do alone, and it's very clearly one of the reasons why we engage intensely with the Saudis and all of our partners in the region on that whole range of issues. And I expect through this conflict and well beyond, we'll maintain that level of collaboration. You mentioned normalization. That's clearly been a major part of our conversation. It's the serious discussion started shortly before I started in this job, kind of not quite a year and a half ago. They have been a common thread of the discussions of senior visitors that have come through here. We see, I think, as the Saudis do themselves and have said so publicly, they would see enormous benefit to that. You know, we have long talked about the benefits of regional integration economically, in terms of security, in terms of a whole range of issues. That we started to see the fruits of that in recent years, and the opportunity, the possibility of having Saudi Arabia be a part of that is just a tantalizing possibility. Obviously, there's a lot hanging on that. It's a tough environment, and there's a lot going on right now. But I would say the basic calculus, the desirability, hasn't really changed. And I think the determination, both of us and our partners here, to see it through exists still.
Mr. Ambassador, you, I really truly respect the pace at which you're running and the number of balls you have up in the air, you and your team. So I'm grateful. Thank you for taking some time to be with us today. I really enjoy, as I said, I take an hour, two, three more hours if you had it, but I enjoy speaking with you.
It was great. It was great being on. It's been a year. I thought it was time that I came on 966. I actually started watching it before, as I was preparing to come to Saudi Arabia. So I was familiar with you, and I was kind of thrilled when we had a chance to meet a few months ago and finally have an opportunity to appear and share some ideas with your viewers.
Well, I'm nothing if not persistent. So, so I appreciate your patience. I appreciate you. Appreciate you listening, and really, it's wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Good. Thank you very much. Talk to you very soon.